majority of the people in the region have taken a strong stance that should send a strong signal to Anglo-American and Northern Dynasty that they're not welcome here.
The Save Our Salmon Initiative passes in the Lake and Peninsula Borough. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Don Young has harsh words for a federal decision protecting endangered sea lions.
If I had any suggestions, go catch the fish. Let the goddamn Navy come out and try to take you down, or NIMS.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
The Save Our Salmon Initiative passed in the Lake and Peninsula Borough by a narrow margin. The final count was 280 to 246. The initiative changes borough code to forbid the granting of permits for any big development, including a mine that would have a significant adverse impact on salmon streams. But as KDLG's Daisha Eaton reports, the battle over the initiative is far from over.
Environmentalists and conservation groups are celebrating a victory in Southwest Alaska after the Save Our Salmon Initiative passed Monday. Anders Gustafsson is the executive director of the Anchorage-based Renewable Resources Coalition, an organization that's brought together commercial, sport, and subsistence fishers in opposition to the development of the giant golden copper prospect. He says the vote sends a strong message.
Well, the initiative passed, and that's fantastic news. That's what we were hoping for. There's a small margin there, but it's going to be a small margin anytime you have a voting populace as small as the Lake and Peninsula Borough. And the bottom line is the majority of the people in the region have taken a strong stance and passed an initiative that should send a strong signal to Cynthia Carroll and the administrative folks at Anglo-American and Northern Dynasty that they're not welcome here.
Voter turnout was high, more than 50%. The ballot measure passed by just 34 votes out of 521 ballots cast. The SOS initiative was proposed this spring by a citizens group, Alaskans for Bristol Bay, which gathered more than 300 signatures in support of getting it on the ballot. There are more than 1,100 voters in the borough, which is located southwest of Anchorage along the Alaska Peninsula and encompasses 7,125 square miles of land and dozens of streams and rivers that serve as the spawning grounds for the largest runs of salmon in the world, those that return to Bristol Bay. The initiative would amend the borough's development permitting code to prevent the development of any large-scale resource extraction activity, including mining, which would destroy or degrade salmon habitat. Mike Heatwool is a spokesman for the Pebble Partnership. He represents the big mining companies Gustafsson says are not welcome in Bristol Bay. Although the initiative passed, Heatwool sees the narrow margin, 34 votes, as a good sign.
I think it does a disservice to just say this was, you know, mine or no mine. I know that's how others want to frame the issue. There's also a fairly large number of folks within the Lake and Peninsula Borough who clearly want to know more about the project. A lot of folks are taking second, third, maybe fourth looks at where we are with the project and the economic opportunity that it may present if it can live up to the high environmental standards that the state and federal government has on the books for a project like this.
Trifon Anguson is the chairman of the board of the Alaska Peninsula Corporation, a village corporation that represents Alaska Native shareholders in the region closest to the proposed mine. He also works as a contracted consultant for the Pebble Partnership. Anguson opposed the SOS initiative because he believes fishing jobs are on the decline for local people, and the mine would bring desperately needed economic development to the region.
A new economic engine in Bristol Bay is needed. We need to look at the mass of people in Bristol Bay. They've ruled out oil and gas because of the environmental issues. Now they're ruling out hard rock mining. What is in store for the people? Nothing. The only way that they can survive is to move on to a different life away from their homes. And once that happens, we've lost the communities forever.
Now the initiative is headed back to court again. The Pebble Limited Partnership, the group seeking to develop the mine, has challenged its legality. So has Alaska Governor Sean Parnell's Attorney General, who argues it would be unenforceable because the Alaska Constitution gives the legislature, not localities, authority over development of state resources. Anchorage Superior Court Judge John Suttick allowed the election to proceed, but said he will sort out the legal issues when the case resumes November 7th. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The management of an endangered stock of Steller sea lions has pitted fishermen and politicians against federal scientists. That was especially clear at a special hearing on the issue held in Seattle yesterday. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
When a congressional committee holds a hearing that asks, does the science support the decision in the title, their answer to the question is usually already implied. That was the case yesterday, when the ranking Republicans on the House Natural Resources Committee gathered testimony on the management of Steller sea lions at a special traveling hearing held in Seattle. Chairman Doc Hastings of Washington State, Alaska Congressman Don Young, and the majority of their witnesses came down hard on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's decision to close down two fisheries to protect an endangered stock of sea lions in the Western Aleutians. Here's Young.
You have no science. That's why you always lean on the term best science available.
And witness Doug Vincent Lang, the state of Alaska's endangered species coordinator.
The conclusion that fishing is affecting the western stock is based on speculation, not hard facts.
Young set the tone for the hearing with his first question for NOAA Fisheries Director Eric Schwab.
Mr. Schwab, do you ever work in Washington, D.C.? Do you work in Washington, D.C.?
My office is based in Silver Spring. I spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C., yes, sir.
That explains how you learn how to dance. You guys are really good at that. I say, I've watched the administration come down time again, dance around and answer better than anybody I've ever seen. So congratulations.
The criticisms that followed were varied. Many of the witnesses emphasized that NOAA used only one indicator, fewer pups being born, to establish a link between commercial fishing and sea lion diet. When questioning Schwab and NOAA scientist Doug DeMaster, Representative Hastings indicated that he was less than impressed with the data used.
I guess I just have to ask it straightforward. Is it true that some of the assumptions on the Steller sea lion feeding behavior was based on just three juvenile males?
Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, could I defer to Dr. DeMaster?
If he answers my question, yes.
I believe the total number was more like 13.
Oh, 13, wow. Okay.
The economic impacts of the closures of the Aka mackerel and Pacific cod fisheries were also discussed. One fishing industry representative testified that companies working in the Western Aleutians had lost over $80 million. Randy Sukata, who is the president of Aleut Enterprise, said that the restrictions have had a ripple effect in ADAC and caused fuel prices to go up.
This is not just a matter of lost opportunity, but it's a matter of ability to heat homes.
In response, Representative Young suggested that ADAC ignore NOAA's policies entirely.
If I had any suggestions, probably don't follow them. It'll get you in trouble. Go catch the fish. Let the goddamn Navy come out and try to take you down, or nymphs.
Of the dozen who were called upon to testify, only one person who didn't work for NOAA actively came to the agency's defense. Michael Levine is an attorney for the conservation group Oceana. He commented that the Endangered Species Act requires NOAA to do anything in its power to boost the Steller sea lion population, regardless of the economic implications.
The law is absolutely clear. Fisheries cannot be authorized unless the National Marine Fisheries Service can ensure that they're not likely to cause jeopardy to Steller sea lions or adversely modify their critical habitat.
Despite the many calls at the hearing for changes to the sea lion management plan, it's unlikely that any action will be taken in the near future to lift the restrictions. The management debate will only reopen in earnest if a review by the Center for Independent Experts finds problems with NOAA's conclusions. The center has not yet initiated its study, and that process typically takes 6 months from its start. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Bethel woman who piqued the world's imagination with a simple photograph.
There seems to be a lot of love out there for dogs and tundra people and and my sign.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
A picture taken on the tundra of western Alaska is generating a lot of interest worldwide. Supporters of the Occupy Wall Street movement are enamored with a single protester's snapshot taken in Bethel. The photo has been featured on the LA Times website, and it was broadcast nationwide on NBC Nightly News. It even got picked up on several major Russian TV networks. From member station KYUK in Bethel, reporter Shane Iverson spoke with the founder of the Occupy the Tundra movement and has this report.
In major cities around the continent, protesters are gathering for the Occupy Wall Street movement. The aim is to draw attention to the excess of corporate greed and the growing economic divide between the very richest people and the rest of the world. Bethel's Diane McCachran says she supports that message, and she wanted to express that to her friends on Facebook. So she had another friend take a little picture of her with her dogs and a sign. She posted that picture, and then the hits started coming. McCachran says she knew something was up when she opened her Facebook account and saw 200 friend requests.
I'm likable, but I'm not that likable.
Soon, thousands of Facebook users were leaving comments and liking the photo. It shows McCachran holding a cardboard sign that reads, Occupy the Tundra. She's kneeling on the tundra, which, like the cardboard, is brown. Mist surrounds her and all three of her dogs as they all look into the camera. And judging by comments, people really like it.
There seems to be a lot of love out there for dogs and tundra people and and my sign.
If she didn't live in a remote corner of the state and really the country, she likely would have joined others in the street.
But my context is here, so I thought I did what I felt was closest and most reasonable and authentic to where I live.
McCachran can often be seen on the outskirts of Bethel, letting her dogs run free in the uninhabited space. Compared to the Occupy Wall Street photos now available on the web, this one looks empty. She thinks that could be the draw.
So I don't know that it's really me so much. I think it's more like what people bring to it. And I'm really struck by how deep-seated some of the desires are around the Occupy Wall Street movement.
She also felt that desire to occupy from her fellow protesters, all of which she admits she owns. That included Seabiscuit, Ruffian.
And the little schnauzer, that's Mr. Snickers. And they love going to the tundra to occupy it.
McCachran is an assistant professor at the UAF Kuskokwim campus in Bethel. She says her next move is to occupy her office. I'm Shane Iverson.
A suit challenging Alaska's proposed new voting district map is moving ahead despite federal approval of the redistricting plan. The Fairbanks North Star Borough, two local residents, and the city of Petersburg have sued to halt the plan. Plaintiffs are opposed to districts they say disenfranchise local voters. Fairbanks Borough Attorney Jill Dolan says last week's pre-clearing of the plan by the U.S. Department of Justice is independent of the state court process.
So a court can still invalidate the board's plan, or it could also find that another plan could also be pre-cleared by the Department of Justice that also meets the Alaska Constitution.
Fairbanks plaintiffs are opposed to the plan's grouping of areas of Esther and the Goldstream Valley into a voting district that stretches to western Alaska. The state redistricting board has to come up with a plan that protects the Alaska Native vote as required by federal law and meets state constitutional stipulations requiring compact and socioeconomically homogeneous voter districts. Board Executive Director Taylor Bickford says Alaska is one of five states covered by the 1971 Voting Rights Act, and the board made adhering to it a priority.
Given that federal law trumps state law, and there are often times when the federal constitutional and Voting Rights Act requirements conflict with Alaska state constitutional requirements, the board worked very hard at balancing the balancing act of making sure that you're complying with the federal law, but that you're also complying with the Alaska Constitution to the greatest extent possible.
The trial is scheduled to start in January. The Alaska Railroad is selling firewood at a discount in Salcha. It's the first of several wood sales planned over the next 3 years during construction of the new Tanana River Bridge. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The railroad and the contractor it hired to build the $190 million bridge across the Tanana River near Salcha both went into the firewood business to help the community and to help smooth relations with area residents as they deal with heavy truck traffic and other activity that comes with such a massive construction project. Mark Peterburs, who's heading up the bridge project for the railroad, says the contractor hauled about 25 truckloads of firewood to the Salcha Fairgrounds. That's about 200 cords, and is now selling it for $100 a cord.
The wood's available now. Obviously, it won't be seasoned for a year, but this way we can get it cut, we can get it off the site, and then it's available for people.
Peterburs says the contractor, Kiewit Pacific, is giving half of the proceeds of those sales to the Salcha Fair Association. Association member Chris Burns says that money will help pay for repairs and maintenance of a community well on the fairgrounds. Burns says officials with the railroad and the Fairbanks North Star Borough came up with the idea to sell the timber at a discount for use as firewood as a way to help nonprofits and to put to good use all the timber that's being harvested from the area where the bridge and other structures are to be built. Mike King is a 17-year Salcha resident who's been hired to manage the firewood sales operation. He says the firewood is mostly white spruce. King is a longtime commercial woodcutter who sells the same basic mix of firewood for about $200 a cord for rounds that are cut to fireplace length.
If people want to stock up on the wood for next year, it's a really good deal.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Alaskan residents will be able to avoid the dreaded baggage fee on Alaska Airlines flights to or from the state starting in November. The airline held Alaska Day open houses at airports across Alaska to announce a waiver for up to 2 bags per trip and new weekly deals. Both are part of a free program the company calls Club 49. Joe Sprague is marketing manager for the airline. He says the program is a response to a survey the airline conducted earlier this year.
We've considered doing some sort of special program for Alaskans for many years, but the survey gave us some deep insights into, you know, how Alaskans feel about air travel and some things that they'd like to see different. So, you know, using that information helped us to really design a program that we think will be beneficial for all Alaskans.
Club 49 also entitles Alaskans to 2 certificates, good for a 30% discount on last-minute one-way tickets. But the baggage fee waiver was the biggest hit with the crowd at Petersburg's airport. Lisa Hernandez looks forward to not having to pay for a couple of bags the next time she travels.
I think it's great because I'm going to be making a couple trips, and you know that they always get you in those bag fees. As much as you book your ticket in advance to try to get it on sale, especially with the PFD funds that they had, you know, the fares, but this is just great, just in time.
Scott McMurrin publishes the Alaska Travelgram email letter newsletter. He says the program could be partly in response to new competition in the market.
I think that they recognize that Alaska is a great market, and I think that they also wisely understand that there are other competitors out there. For example, JetBlue came up this summer. So I think there's a little bit of a preemptive strike here. So I think that's a good thing for travelers.
McMurrin lists Alaska Airlines as a sponsor of his Alaska Travelgram website. The sale announced with the program today includes fares between Anchorage and Bethel, Barrow, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, and Seattle. The sale fares are open to anyone. To get the other benefits, you have to sign up for the Club 49 program on the Alaska Airlines website. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has caused a wave of confusion in Juneau and Homer concerning the latest flood maps issued by the agency. According to the new maps, parts of the Homer Spit are now somehow lower in elevation than they used to be and are therefore more susceptible to storm surges and tsunamis. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, city officials and Senator Lisa Murkowski are looking to FEMA for answers.
Homer City Manager Walt Reedy says the issue centers around the potential costs associated with flood danger. He says the city participates in the National Flood Insurance Program, which offers reduced rate flood insurance to local residents as long as they comply with special building standards for flood-prone areas. As part of that program, FEMA periodically provides flood maps which show where potential flood hazard areas are located.
The thing that got the city's attention was that the new maps show they have increased the danger on some of the properties that the city owns on the Spit.
The area most affected, says Reedy, is along Fish Dock Road, a heavily developed part of the Spit that is home to the city-owned ice plant and fish dock, plus many private businesses that lease city land. The new maps say this part of the Spit now has a higher chance of flooding due to high winds, storm surges, and tsunamis. The change appears to be based on new measurements in the area, which put the properties in question at a lower elevation than they used to be. But the maps are highly technical and confusing, even to city officials who are used to reading them. One thing is for sure, though, according to Reedy, the new maps, if they go into effect, could have significant economic impacts for the area.
If you're going to build in those areas, you're either going to have to spend more money on construction because you're going to have better construction standards, or you're going to pay more for insurance, or both.
On Wednesday, during a hearing before the Senate Homeland Security Appropriations Subcommittee, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski confronted FEMA head Craig Fugate on the flood maps issue. She said she had not yet seen an adequate response to a letter she sent in June regarding the city of Juneau's issues with their new flood maps.
The question for you this afternoon is how is FEMA addressing the concerns that communities, whether it's Juneau or whether it's Homer or whether it's communities across the country, about these flood maps, the accuracy of them, and what recourse any property owners may have in terms of being able to comment once the period has closed out. So if you can just kind of speak generally to that, I would appreciate it.
Fugate responded that the flood mapping process is always a challenging one for FEMA.
Anytime we have map revisions that adversely affect folks where there are going to be people that find themselves in the special risk area or that the area of risk is greater than what had previously been mapped. And we know that that communications is a key part of educating to make sure people understand the risk. So we continue to work on that.
Reedy says FEMA officials have told the city that the new flood maps are not likely to go into effect until next spring. They have not yet, however, agreed to present their findings and explain their flood maps to the people of Homer. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
A Sitka author who penned a fishy parody of The Night Before Christmas 9 years ago has discovered that even quick work can have long literary legs. Will Swaggle partnered with artist Colin Hereforth to publish an illustrated children's version of The Bite Before Christmas in 2009. The book and the story of how it was created occupy the center spread of this month's Pacific Fishing magazine. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
It was the night before Christmas throughout Sitka Sound. Not a creature stirred anywhere on the fish grounds. The hoochies were hung in the wheelhouse with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there.
Catchy, isn't it? That's Swaggle reading from his modern adaptation of the 1823 classic by Clement Clark Moore. Swaggle appeared last December on the Alaska Public Radio Network's Talk of Alaska with a panel of authors and publishing industry experts. That might have been as far as anyone could expect a fishing poem to go, but Swaggle, just back from a tour, says The Bite Before Christmas has legs.
The fishing culture is so strong, it's like everybody got it immediately, and that's probably, the most satisfying thing to me to see people in Gloucester, Mass, people in Port Orford, Oregon, people in Westport, Washington. They just look at it and they go, oh, this is about us.
Swagel is a former newspaper reporter who now runs a weekly advertising circular called The Sitka Soup. The Soup has original editorial content, sometimes a crossword puzzle even, and a commentary called Our Town. All are written by Swagel. The bite before Christmas came to Swagel as he was staring down the barrel of a deadline, and his effort tided the Soup over for several Decembers.
But it was at least 5 years before the book came out that we had been running it every year in the Soup. And it was kind of like, I didn't have to write in Our Town for Christmas because I had this great poem that people were telling me to run again. And then people started saying, do a book, do a book, do a book.
Swagel partnered with a local watercolor artist, Colin Hereforth, who worked a solid year on the 18 illustrations in the book. Bight is spelled B-I-G-H-T and refers to the small sheltered anchorages favored by Southeast trollers. Hereforth's paintings evoke not just the spirit of the holiday, but the spirit of traditional hook-and-line fishing. The first printing arrived in Sitka on the day before Thanksgiving in 2009. Swagel says he must have caught the editors of Pacific Fishing magazine this year at the right time for their deadline. He says it was only a couple of weeks after his interview with Pacific Fishing's Don McManaman that The Bite was featured in the magazine's October centerfold. Now, like any author or artist who lands a hit, Swagel is thinking about what's next, but he won't have any regrets if The Bite is his only keeper.
You know, if this is what I was known for, I guess I would be pretty happy with that because, you know, it's sweet and it's authentic and that's what I'd like to be.
Athwart to the starboard, I jumped with some dread, threw open the porthole and stuck out my head. And what should the dark waves I visaged now feature but a mythical skiff drawn by eight ocean creatures.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And finally tonight, we have a correction. Last night, we reported that tobacco giant Philip Morris owns several food products and restaurant chains, but that is not correct. The company divested themselves of the Kraft brand and several other brands in 2007. Now they sell cigarettes and smokeless tobacco almost exclusively. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Dillingham, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production, Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. And by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.